Episode 82 of Outlander Cast is brought to you by Jet.com. For $10 off your first three orders over $35, visit Jet.com and enter promo code OutlanderCast at checkout.
People disappear all the time. Young girls run away from home. Children stray from their parents and are never seen again. Housewives take the grocery money in a taxi to the train station. Most are found eventually. Disappearances, after all, have explanations. Usually.
All the way from Cranston, Rhode Island, welcome to Outlander Cast. It's a podcast dedicated to the show Outlander on Stars. Hi, everybody, and welcome. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name's Blake, and I'm having flashbacks of our earliest seasons.
I know.
Listening to that intro, I mean, no longer do we have it as part of our main intro from now on, but still, it felt good to hear those words again, and I am so happy because we are here to re-inspect and go over once again that first episode of Sassenach.
Yes. How exciting.
I think it is exciting.
This is how you do in Droughtlander, or any time of the year, let's be real. You revisit, especially the first episode. I mean, it's such a beauty of an episode.
It is. And I wanted to revisit it because, you know, as now that the summer season has started and a lot of new shows are coming back into the fold, you're seeing brand new pilots and brand new series premieres. And it reminded me of how excited we were when Outlander started to come out. Mm-hmm. And we decided, okay, we're going to podcast about this and we're going to have fun with it. And, you know, obviously we have now what we have now. We have a beautiful community that we've all created together. And I'm so excited about that. But that one little butterfly moment of watching Sassenach for the first time and seeing those gleaming hills, you know, of the Scottish Highlands, I remember not knowing what was going to happen and being excited by it and looking to you to be like, okay, is this going to be good? Is this not going to be good? Mm-hmm. And of course, we all know what's happened since. So
yeah, well, you know, Outlander holds a special place in all of our hearts. Let's be real. Whether the books helped you traverse a trying time in your life, or the show inspires you to find your own true love, or heck, maybe you just really love comparing and contrasting your favorite story ever told. Well, in the end, everyone has a purpose when it comes to Outlander.
Right. Like, you know, mine was to make my wife happy. So, you know, I told her I would podcast about it. Hashtag happy wife, happy life.
Very funny.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, I know. But at, you know, some point, what there's one specific moment in your life. And, you know, you either opened up the cover of Outlander and read those first words, people disappear all the time. Or you clicked on to Stars and hit play and you saw that, like I said, that those gleaming hills of the Scottish Highlands for, you know, like the first time ever.
Yeah, well, the point is, no matter what, you started. You began this journey somewhere, sometime, and haven't looked back since. In fact, it made such a lasting impression that you're now listening to a podcast about Outlander, which, by the way, I am not knocking. Please, 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 keep listening.
Yes,
keep
please.
Listening.
Don't turn it off.
No, thank you. Thank you. And for our patrons, keeping patrons, thank you. But starting a new book or a new show is an extremely personal experience.
Yes, it is.
It has to capture you, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you want, if you want to be captured, it has to do it. But it's not just as simple as you think. The funny thing is that you think you're consuming Outlander, but it also needs you just as badly as you need it.
Right.
Okay. The book or the show,
yeah.
You know, like it has to communicate back to you.
Yeah, you have to want more. And really, you have to need more from the show.
Mm-hmm.
It has to, like you said, sweetheart, it has to grip you and you have to grip it, because if you don't engage it, it's never consumed. It's kind of, it reminds me of like that saying, you know, if a tree falls or
in the woods
and nobody hears it, does it really fall?
Yeah.
Like if a book or a show is never consumed or it's never engaged, does it really exist? Does anybody really care about it?
So whether the book, the show, or both, like you, it must begin somewhere. So today we are going to take a look at where Outlander, the show, began.
Yes, not the book, because we all know that, number one, I'm not going to read the books, but number two, we have not yet reached our Patreon goal of $650 per month in order for me to read the first book of Outlander.
So if listening to this episode, you cringe at any moment because you're like, Blake, you know nothing. You know nothing because you haven't read this book, even though Blake is not going to read all of the books. Like, he wants to see the shows first. He wants to experience them without having read them. He has decided that he will read the first book, Outlander, the one that started it all, if we reach our next Patreon goal. So head on over to Patreon. That's patreon.com/OutlanderCast. To make that goal possible.
All right, so today, like we said earlier, we are going to tackle how Sassenach differs from the traditional pilot mode or model of television, and what about Sassenach works, what doesn't work, how it sets, you know, the table for the rest of what we're about to watch for the remainder of the series. And really, like I said, we were talking earlier about the new shows that are coming out, and you know, we just finished The Leftovers. Mm-hmm. That series has now finally just concluded this past week. And I loved that pilot episode. I thought that was such a great pilot episode. So I wanted to look back at where Outlander matches up against other great pilot episodes, and where it ranks among the best series in television history. And also what I wish Sassenach could have done differently in my eyes to be a more effective episode. And I am making a distinction here that Sassenach is different from a traditional pilot, and that's by design, because Sassenach is not a pilot. In fact, it's what's called a series premiere, and exploring the difference between what a pilot, as I put in quotes, is and what a series premiere is, that will color, I think, how we should interpret the effectiveness of Sassenach as a first episode, because they have to be looked at, a pilot and a series premiere, differently. And I think this episode will be different than our first episode we did for Sassenach, because
correct,
now we're just talking about the mechanics of a show, how it's broken up, and how it was presented to us, not necessarily, oh my God, we loved this shot, or oh my God, Jamie looks so handsome, or, you know, like we're actually going to kind of really dig deep into this episode.
Okay. So what is the difference between a pilot episode versus a series premiere?
Yes. Well, thanks to Professor Wikipedia.
Yes. Thank you, Professor. You teach me so much.
I will read this portion. A television pilot is a standalone episode of a television series that is used to sell a show to a television network. And at the time of its creation, the pilot is meant to be a testing ground to gauge whether a series will be successful, and is therefore a test episode of an intended television series. It is an early step in the development of a television series, much like the pilot studies serve as precursors to the start of a larger activity. In the case of a successful television series, the pilot is commonly the first episode that is aired of a particular series under its own name. So, like, a lot of times you see a brand new series and the first episode is titled pilot.
Correct.
It's not because there's a pilot in an episode of some series. That's just how pilots are made. They're called pilots.
It's kind of like when we had our son and we didn't know what to name him, so right. we just named him Baby. And they wouldn't let us leave the
We should have called
hospital.
Him Pilot because we should have realized...
that would have been so smart.
Do we want this kid? Do we not want this kid? Ultimately, the television networks use pilots to discover whether an entertaining concept can be successfully realized. And after seeing this sample of the proposed product, networks will then determine whether the expense of an additional episodes is actually justified.
Okay, wait, hold up. So you air the first episode, and if people don't like it, you can cut the show after the first episode?
Yes, that happens. But a lot of the times what will happen is networks will create the pilot, and then they'll do test screenings.
Okay.
You know, as a matter
How
of fact...
How do I get on those?
I know. As a matter of fact, it's rather apropos that we're talking about this because the new Wonder Woman movie has just come out, right? And we actually just saw it last night.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a pilot made for NBC about a Wonder Woman show. And the people that made it were really excited about it, and they brought in this actress, and it was going to be a great big deal. The pilot got made. NBC saw it, and they were like, nope.
So sad.
We're not doing that.
Ruh-roh.
So they are ultimately, pilots are thought best as prototypes of shows that that are to follow because elements often change from the pilot series. And a little known fact is that only, I think, a quarter of the pilots that are made in American television actually make it to the public. The only 25% of them, only a quarter. Can you imagine that?
No.
So it's a proven tactic for networks, and it's a proven thing that people will go out and if they like it, great. If they don't, they don't have to make it. They don't have to waste the money on
mm-hmm.
it. A problem with it, though, is that you're getting what we get now, which is 45,000 CSI shows because they know that the public likes CSI. They know they like the Quanticos. They know they like shows like Blacklist. You're not getting any creativity necessarily. They're just going with remaking movies like The A-Team or Limitless or Lethal Weapon because it's a proven commodity. They don't want to spend all the money on it, so they don't have to take risks. And they don't waste the money on risky shows like Hannibal, or The Leftovers, or even Outlander. But like I said, Outlander is different. Outlander and Sasanok is different because it is not a pilot; it is mm-hmm. a series
premiere,
which means ultimately it was ordered to series.
I'm confused. Okay, what? Ordered to series? I feel like it's like a takeout order.
No, it's not a takeout order.
I'd like Sasanok and yeah. The
and,
Wedding. Thank
and
you.
And a Mugu Gaipan while we're at it. Thanks. No, okay, so in order to series is, it's a relatively new phenomenon, actually. In the last few years, companies like Netflix... and even like WGN or A&E, HBO, and yes, even Stars, they have started to shift their method of getting television shows on their networks by essentially commissioning straight to series projects that have gone on to be really highly successful. I mean, Game of Thrones is one of them. Even we're talking about Outlander right now. Shows like The Sopranos, all of those shows were just ordered straight to series. In other words, HBO and Stars and Netflix, they make commitments to buy and air entire seasons that are 10 to 13 episodes, maybe even 16, like in the case of Outlander. They're doing them right off the bat without ever seeing a pilot. All they see is a script.
That's pretty amazing and crazy.
Right. Well, you know, it's there are reasons for it, but like when you think about it, it's like, okay, here's an apropos example. It'd be like I met you on Match.
Yes.
We did. But without ever talking to you, without ever having a date with you, without ever hearing your voice, without ever seeing you, without ever seeing your beautiful makeup that you're wearing right now.
Thank you. MinuteWithMary.com.
Shameless plug. I would have proposed to you. And that would have been it. That would have been the how we've been courted. That would have been our marriage. That would have been everything. And you probably would have looked at me like, whoa, bro.
You're crazy.
So there are reasons for doing this. And it makes sense on a lot of different levels. I mean, there you can attract higher end writing talent like Ron Moore. Ron Moore coming off of Battlestar Galactica or Damon Lindelof or Vince Gilligan. Like even like Better Call Saul, which is based off of Breaking Bad, that was just ordered to series because Vince Gilligan was writing it. And he said, I have an idea in mind. And AMC said, and Sony said, awesome, let's do it. You're Vince Gilligan. You're the man. You created Breaking Bad. We're just going to take your show, your idea, and we're just going to make a show out of it. Or even higher end acting talent like Halle Berry or even Bryan Cranston or, you know, those kind of guys. Anthony Hopkins. Westworld did not have a pilot. It was just Westworld. And shows like guys like Ed Harris and Anthony Hopkins, James Marsden, all those guys, they just showed up because they knew we're going to make this show. And that's going to be that.
It was a promise. This is happening.
Right. Okay. So in the end, series premiere of a straight to order series, the difference is it's not necessarily a proving ground like a pilot would be. They don't necessarily have to follow the same rules as a traditional pilot because their existence, it isn't dependent on the success of a pilot being warmly received. And because of that, ordered to series shows or series premieres are like guaranteed contracts.
Awesome.
You know, like which means that they can be a little bit more strange. They can be a little more chancy with all the things that they do. And they can function as a smaller part of an entire story that has already been guaranteed to be told.
I like that. Okay, so now that we figured out why being a series premiere was really important to the context of Sassenach, let's begin our breakdown by talking about the episode in general. Is that cool?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Awesome. All right, so after rewatching Sassenach a million times for myself,
yeah,
and yourself as well, what do we think Sassenach as an episode by itself did really, really well?
I think it really was first gorgeous. It was exquisitely shot. And
That mean you're taking me to Scotland someday soon?
Yes.
Because that's where I want to go. After seeing Sassenach, I'm like, I want a car. I want a blue car. Was it a blue car? I'm blanking.
I think it was a black car. She had the blue coat.
Oh, God, I know. Everything I see is blue. I'm like, the blue vase, the blue coat, the blue birds. Like,
all right, Marie, calm down.
No, I'm just saying Outlander makes me see blue. I want to just drive around a convertible and go to Scotland thanks to this episode.
Right. I don't blame you. I think I'm on the way there. And that's, again, what Sassenach did, I think, really well. It showed you Scotland. It showed you the Highlands. Mm-hmm. And it was, again, it was exquisitely shot. It was perfectly lit throughout the entire episode. I mean, going from Claire's time in World War II France to her frantic run through the Highlands and, you know, culminating in a scene that I think really the show has still yet to top in terms of the overall tone, theme, the excellence of it, and what it was trying to get across, which was, of course, the summoning at the stones.
Yeah,
That is one of the most beautiful scenes of any television show I have ever seen. Mm-hmm. Another great thing that they really did, I felt like, was they really tried to show you a lot of different things and not necessarily tell you them. I mean, for example, the color depth and the saturation from the muted 1940s to like that really vibrant, beautiful greens and reds of the 1740s. That's a perfect example of showing you that the audience and Claire are now in a different time. It's time, it's tenor, it's setting. Even though it's still Scotland, it's still the Highlands, the entire tenor and everything about it has changed. And that's just an in-camera color change, right? Mm-hmm. I think it really did well with that. And on a story level, I think Sassenach does an excellent job, too, of exposing you to the world that it plans on inhabiting. Its distinctive setting, like I said, and introducing you to most of the main players that we, the audience, are going to be spending, I think, at least 16 odd hours with over the course of the first season, and eventually
and even more. Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I mean, we're nerds here, so we're spending a lot of time with these people.
Yes.
So
yes.
I think it does a really great job in exposing you to most of the main players that you're going to see right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So where did you think it lacked?
Well,
I don't want to
sound like a Debbie Downer here.
Oh God!
But
put on your little.
Wait, hold on. I got it right here.
You know who you are going to be right now?
Who?
You're going to be that like nitpicky English teacher when you think you've written like the best essay ever, and you come back and they're like, it's a colon, not a semicolon, but they do it in a red pen and it breaks your soul.
Did I ever tell you this story? Real quick. When I was in college, my first paper I ever written out of high school, I thought I was like the smartest kid on the planet. I could write papers, blah, blah, blah. I was my first paper in college. Mm-hmm. I banged it out in like a half hour because I thought I was the man.
You thought you were wicked smart.
And it was about the Iliad. And I thought, dude, this is right up my alley. I'm a history major. I love the Iliad. I love classics. Like, I got this.
Yeah.
Pass it in. The next day. My professor comes back, he gives me my paper, and he just looks at me, and you can just sense the dread on his face. Like,
yes.
I open it up, I look at it, and it's just a sea of red. The whole thing is just covered in red. Red marks everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I'm flipping through the pages. I'm like, oh my God. Halfway through my paper, like a page and a half into it, the professor writes at the top in red marker, "Mr. Larson, this is a waste of my time. Redo this. If you don't redo this, you will get an F right now."
Oh my God.
I'll never forget that. "Mr. Larson, this is a waste of my time."
Oh my God.
I'll never forget that. So yes, that's how I feel a little bit here.
Okay.
But I'm not going to go that crazy.
Thank God, because I loved Sassenach.
I did. But I do think that Sassenach also does have its fair share of problems.
It has its places that it could have improved.
It could have been better. Like, I think most notably, I think it suffers from a similar problem most pilots and series premieres of brand new series often suffer from, which it tries too hard to tell you what it is instead of trusting you, the viewer, to understand what it wants to be. I know I just said to you, it did make a great use of show and not tell when it came to the color saturation changes, and it showed you that there is a big difference in what you're watching.
Mm-hmm.
But we all know about the voiceovers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they are what they are, and I don't need to go into that. It just tried too hard to tell you that, oh my God, you have to know this portion. You have to know X, Y, and Z, because if you don't...
Claire will tell you in her very tough accent.
But regardless, make no mistake about it. I mean, the high wire act here of trying to show and tell is hard. It's very hard. I mean, the pilot or a series premiere, it really does have to hold your hand as it dispenses the proper context. And to be honest, I think as a viewer, you probably want your hand to be held a little bit as well, because you need that information that it needs to dispel or it needs to disperse and dispense. Mm-hmm. You need that information. The issue that a lot of premieres have is that it can't alienate your sense of empathy or sympathy for the main character from the visual perspective. I mean, TV is a visual medium. You need that sense of show, not tell. But of course, I do suspect that given, you know, Ron Moore's vast accomplishments in the television world, that this isn't either the fault of the writers or even Ron Moore himself. And I say that because I think Sassenach, despite the fact that it's trying to tell you so much and it's trying too hard to tell you instead of trusting you, it's an episode that has a lot to accomplish within a 60-minute time frame. And it has to break out, I think, all the stops to get there, to be honest. I mean, the show has to communicate its characters. It has to communicate the setting, the world of the show, the plot of the episode, and a general feel of the series. And it has to give you a basic representation into the world you're about to invest your highly sought-after time. But also, and most importantly, it has to get your emotional investment.
Right away.
Immediately. And like I know, we've talked about Ron Moore and Damon Lindelof, Vince Gilligan. Now even like Twin Peaks guy, David Lynch, he's come back to run Twin Peaks again. Their immediate inclination is, again, to show you and not tell it to you. And, of course, TV is a visual medium, and it should be utilized in that manner. I mean, for example, why have a character tell you how they feel in a given situation, either in a voiceover or in an exposition, a dump to another character, when you can just show their emotion via body language or something that they're doing in their actions? Because if you're writing an episode of television whose emotional core is married to complete exposition, then you aren't writing an affecting journey that takes advantage of the full medium. But then again, no exposition or words, or even in this case, voiceover, means zero audible communication. And thereby, there's just no context. So you have to have a fine line of both. And I think a really good example of this was when we see Claire meet up with all of the Highlanders in the cabin for the first time right before she heals Jamie's shoulder. She meets up with them, and she's there, and she sees Jamie, and she sees that his shoulder's all screwed up. She and we inherently have no clue what the Highlanders are saying when they're speaking Gaelic as they talk around her. But we know, given the way that it's shot and their body language, that they are definitely speaking about Claire. They don't trust her. And we should be a little worried, and she should be a little worried about not only where she is, but when she is. So having said all this, really, in the end, I think pilots and first episodes have to walk this tightrope of spoon-feeding you the information to bring you along on this journey together so you have enough context, but it also has to fulfill its artistic purpose of showing you the journey so you feel like you're experiencing it along with all of the main characters.
Okay. All right. I can get on board with that.
I mean, do you feel like that they did a good job showing and telling, or not showing or telling? Like, what do you think about that?
It's so tough because I already read the book.
Right. Okay.
Like, this is where, you know, those of you who might be like, shame on you, Blake. Shame. Shame, as they say in Game of Thrones. Shame.
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 Ding.
You know, I already knew them. I already loved them. I already had all this character development. So I was more just excited to see these things in the flesh, and not really in the flesh. It was like flesh on TV, but to see Scotland and to start to hear the music. Like, I was just so sensory overloaded versus just having my physical book. So it's interesting for me to hear this perspective for through you. But I want to know how, like, episode structure, how the actual structure of Sassenach fits into all this and why it's important for this premiere episode.
Right. So we were talking about structure earlier and how pilots and series premieres, they have to accomplish the same thing, essentially. And again, Sassenach is not a pilot, and it is a series premiere. It was ordered straight to series. But the two, the pilot and series premieres, they don't have to follow the same path. They don't have to. Because again, like we talked about, series premieres can be a little bit more daring than a pilot. A pilot is usually very formulaic. But that doesn't mean that they don't actually do the same things. They actually still have to accomplish the same goal, which is it needs to command your attention and tell enough of a satisfying and self-contained story to entice you, the viewer, to come back for more. So more often than not, pilots and series premieres, including Outlander, can and do still follow the same template and how they're engineered to tell a story. And that is this. It's a teaser followed by four acts that reveal more about the characters, plot, and the setting of the show with each successive act.
Okay, so if okay, so X. Okay, how did Ron Moore do that in this episode of Sassenach? Like, did he? Do you think he managed to introduce Claire, Jamie, Frank, Scotland, the Mackenzies, everybody, along with telling a satisfying, self-contained story that introduced us to the world?
Yeah.
Did
well,
he? I don't. Yeah, like explain this.
Does he actually do it?
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, let's just talk about what a teaser is and what it's supposed to do. A teaser is the first element of a pilot or a season
premiere. Like the first five minutes. Okay.
It's like your initial dive into the show. Kind of like we talked about getting married. It's kind of like your first date with a guy or a girl.
Butterflies.
So your first date, as we all know, is the best version of yourself. And if that were the case for my wife,
that would have been terrible.
That would have been a very bad thing. Because
I showed up 20 minutes late.
20 minutes late, and she got hammered.
Oh, I did.
She got hammered.
I didn't eat dinner.
She was smoked.
I drank 7 Guinness on an empty stomach.
Yes, she did.
And I was 20 minutes late because I wasn't going to pay for parking. I'm cheap.
I thought I was getting abandoned. And then we got married. Hey, look at that. All right.
Look at that.
So like I said, it's the best version of yourself sans Mary. Okay.
Do not go on first dates with me. Thank God I can never go on a first date again.
Thank God. The pilot or your first date, it's carefully manicured. It's properly planned, except when you're married. And you have enough story to tell someone to get them interested in you. Hopefully, like when Mary told me that she was obsessed with Yoda coming out in episode 2 of Star Wars and chanting Yoda at a 12 o'clock in the morning showtime, which I did the same exact thing. So that's why we're probably married. So in other words, the teaser is quick. It's meant to captivate you. It's meant to grab your attention and introduce you to the world that you're about to enter. Elements from the entire show really should be present in the teaser, and it usually lasts, I'd say, like we talked about earlier, maybe between 3 and 5 minutes. And once the teaser ends, the credits come up.
Yeah.
Okay, like the opening titles. So Outlander's script begins its teaser like this. Like I've gotten a hold online of Outlander's first script, and I'll be citing the script here a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So the script starts off like this. Hold on to the Scottish Highlands in all of their glory. Mountains frame hard against the rolling clouds, the weather threatening to change for good or ill at any moment, vibrant, rich colors of autumn, shades of greens, browns, and yellows streaked across the land. And then we're introduced to our first voiceover. People disappear all the time. And the voiceover continues to talk about the woman and young girls vanishing and how there always is an explanation. Usually. Then we flash forward to Claire Randall, who's 27 years old, standing on a cobblestone street in a small village in post-war Scotland, dressed in modest, warm clothes, her forever unruly curls cascading over her features in a brisk wind. She stares at a shop window filled with household goods, embroidered tea cloths and cozies, pitchers and glasses, a stack of pine tins, and a set of 3 vases. Then we have more voiceover. Strange, the things you remember. Back to the script. She stares at the blue patterned vase in the window, and the shop is closed. And then, of course, Claire walks into that famous blue coat down towards the inn that she'd be later staying at. More voiceover. It was a Tuesday afternoon, 6 months after the end of the war. And then we smash cut to a flashback scene of a field hospital in the spring of 1945. The script says, screams of agony fill the tent as the 2 British soldiers try to hold down another badly wounded soldier. British Army nurse Claire Randall calmly goes about cutting off the remnants of the wounded man's pants, exposing horribly mangled legs with jagged bones, cutting through grievous lacerations. Suddenly, a spray of blood splashes across Claire and the other soldiers. The wounded man jerks in spasms. Of course, the doctor shows up during the procedure, and then calmly and rather assertively pushes Claire out of the way. And as the script notes, there's no thanks for Claire, who saved the man's life. But she neither notices nor cares. She's too busy working for her patient. She steps out over the field hospital, tired, bloodied, and numb, noticing that a happy moment, finally, the war is over, and she's handled a bottle of champagne from some random lady.
Yes!
From which she takes a generous swig.
A swig. She drinks.
She downs it.
Gallon. Yeah.
But the thing that we're getting here is that Claire is alone.
Yeah.
She is alone. And we end it with the final voiceover. VE Day, the end of the bloodiest and most terrible of all wars in human history, grows fainter with each passing day. But I can still recall every detail of the life I wanted sitting in a window. I sometimes wonder if I had bought that vase and made a home for it. Would that have changed things? Would I have been happy? Who can say? But I do know this, even now, after all the pain and the death and the heartbreak that followed, I still would make that same choice. Mm-hmm. Boom. End teaser.
Done.
Done.
Well, it feels like this teaser is low-key, despite the blood-curdling screams from the injured soldiers in World War II, of course.
Yep.
It's reflective.
Yep.
It's very moody, mm-hmm. very, very moody. And it kind of sets a general tone of introspection as opposed to action. You know, it's really like get inside Claire's mind, get inside her frame of reference. And it feels like Ron accomplishes everything he needs to get across, I think, right?
I would say that getting to know Claire here is important because the show is so heavily invested in Claire. Mm-hmm. She's the main protagonist. The only reason why this show exists is because of Claire. So I think getting to know Claire is really good. He does a great job at it. Because immediately we understand that this show will take place in the Highlands. It's focused on a woman who served in World War II as a nurse and who wasn't necessarily appreciated for her work and felt alone and isolated from the world, I think. But yet, in an unrelated segment, we're talking about disappearances and people leaving their homes
all the time.
But then we have this juxtaposition again of Claire having a voiceover about how she wanted a home and why that vase could represent a home. But then we have more contradiction because she didn't buy the vase. And even though she thinks she could have it, she could have been happy if she had it and she bought it, she would still make that same choice regardless to walk away and undergo all the pain, the death, and the heartbreak. So there's a lot of contradiction, but the thing that it does, it says, why? Why does she do this? It leaves us asking, what's the choice that she made? What is coming after her? What makes all the death worth it? And like I said,
a Scott.
We need to know. The pilot has to make you, or the series premiere has to make you need more.
Yeah.
And we need to know what made all this worth it. And of course, to Claire, it makes tons of sense.
I'm confused.
But
I'm confused.
Okay, why are you confused?
Well, you just said it accomplishes its goal, and I feel like you're not acting like it does. I'm confused. Well, I feel like you're contradicting yourself.
Well, I'm contradicting myself because the teaser is full of contradiction.
What?
Because despite of all the voiceover work, we, the viewer, in my opinion, are left somewhat unfulfilled.
You, the show watcher viewer. Let's get that straight.
Yeah, but again, and this is the ultimate debate. The show has to stand separate from the book. Yes, it's okay that the book readers know what's coming. But you have to create a television show as though the book does not exist to the viewer.
Okay, well, was it an effective trailer? Yes or no?
Teaser.
Whatever, teaser.
Okay. Like I said, I think the viewer is left somewhat unfulfilled because there's no inference into what we're about to watch. Yes, we want to know what is coming next and what made the death worthy of her choice, but we don't know anything significant about Claire's impending journey. We don't know anything about it. We just know that there's a woman here who wanted a home, saw the vase, she was a nurse, and that's it. Mm-hmm. We see Scottish Highlands, but it's not necessarily a given that they're Scottish Highlands. It could be England. It could be Iceland. It could be anywhere.
Yep.
So it doesn't give you an immediate sense of where you are, what you're doing, and what the next 20 minutes or 30 minutes or 40 minutes is going to give you. So is it an effective teaser? Yes and no.
In Blake's opinion?
Yes and no. But we'll get to that in a little bit. We'll save that for the end of the episode.
Ooh, suspenseful, Blake.
See, that's a professional tease. That's why we are an award-winning, Marconi-nominated, Emmy award-winning podcast show. I mean, that's a professional tease.
Okay.
That's what it is. So, well then, why don't we just discuss what happens in the rest of the episode.
Please.
What do you think?
Well, I'm done discussing the teaser, so I would like to move on. I have the attention span of a mouse.
All right. So remember, television shows and specifically
pilots.
Hold on.
You said there's four acts?
There are
Jesus,
four acts.
Jesus Louise. God, okay. Okay.
We're not going to go in depth into all the acts like
Thank
we did the teaser.
Christ! It's a TV show. Okay, but I love this TV show. So what is Act 1 supposed to
be? I told you, we're going to do this differently than how we normally do it.
Oh, my God.
You went into this eyes wide open, kiddo.
Just lead the train.
All right, so television shows, and specifically pilots, are broken up into a teaser and four acts. We all know that. We just already gone through that. And each act exists to introduce new elements and important facets of the show and the characters. So Act 1. Right?
Yes.
What's it supposed to accomplish?
I don't know. Life? People? Scotland?
Act one.
Sex?
Yes. Essentially.
Squeak, 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 squeak.
We have to get... This episode's going off the rails already. It's only like a half hour into it.
Oh my God. Press pause. I need to go get my coffee.
That will help.
I'm back. It's iced. I'm so excited. Let's do this. Okay.
All right. So,
all right, Act one.
All right. Well, we'll speed this up for you. So Ron has to set up Claire's marriage and the magic and superstition of Scotland.
Yes.
And as we all know, Outlander is heavily focused on Claire Randall / Fraser / Beecham / whatever name she wants to go with for the time.
You don't even know all the names she's going to eventually have. Love it.
Not only is she our protagonist and our main character, she's also our surrogate. She's our entry into the crazy world of the Scottish Highlands, and that we will watch for the rest of the series and what it will entail for the rest of the series in either the 18th or the 20th centuries. And it seems rather self-evident, but a lot rides on the success of this character. For us to understand the show, we need to understand her life, and her context. So she's in a car driving through the Highlands on a second honeymoon with Frank, or at least that's what he calls it, of course. It continues with a voiceover, a way to celebrate the end of the war years and begin our lives anew. But it was more than just that. We didn't discuss it, but I think we both felt a holiday would serve as a convenient masquerade for the real business of getting to know the people we had become 6 years apart. So for the most part, whatever she experiences for the first time, we, the audience, are experiencing for it the first time as well. So when she sees the blood on the door in Inverness, we see it and we know something else is happening here outside of our comfortable realm. They meet Mrs. Baird, who follows that up with talking about ghosts and Samhain. So we know now that mysticism and superstition is abound in the area, setting up Claire's eventual and incredible journey. But as Frank normally does, he dumps a bunch of historical knowledge upon us, which tells us that he's smart and on his way to being a professor at Oxford. And Claire actually liked Frank's passion for history, given the fact that he spent so much time with her Uncle Lim on expeditions in Egypt. So even though it's their honeymoon, Frank is in the Highlands, really, to study his own family history, giving us a look into what he really values, and also what Claire doesn't seem to mind. True, her relationship with Frank is still tense and uncomfortable, but as Claire says, they could always fall back on intimacy. And they do, in the bed at the inn, and on Claire's urging, on their excursion to a ruined Castle Leoc.
It all seems great, but is it really?
Well, we know that Claire is a strong woman, and yet she seems to be set aside by Frank for other demands. We sense through ourselves and the lens of Claire that there is something about Scotland, something about that vase, that feels like home, even though she's British. Claire and we know a part of her life is missing as a result of this first act so far. And despite the fact that she's back with Frank, we know that given her admission in the teaser, that she was searching for a home and that she would still make her choice regardless of her foreknowledge of the events that are about to happen. So we know that Frank, despite what we're seeing, is not her home. Mm-hmm. Nothing makes this more clear than Mrs. Graham's reading of Claire's marriage line, where it forks and runs parallels with two marriages, introducing the concept of a double life, one we are about to see. But also, and more importantly, her final voiceover before Act 2. Before the war, we were inseparable. But for the next 6 years, we saw each other for a grand total of 10 days.
Ugh.
When the war had ended, we both thought things would return to the way they once were. But they hadn't. But I never considered leaving Frank. I loved him still, and I knew he loved me. And as the script says, she stops in front of a shop window, and we realize that we've returned to that moment of Claire standing in front of the shop, staring at the vases back in the teaser.
I want that vase and that coat. I'll take the coat. Okay, continue.
And it follows up with, whatever difficulties we faced, I knew we would face them together. And in the end, we would always be together.
Which is like such a great phrase for marriage.
Right.
Whatever difficulties we face, we would face them together. And in the end, we would always be together. Such a great phrase, except when it comes in Outlander. People are never together. We're going to take a little break to tell you a little bit more about today's sponsor, Jet.com. So what is this Jet.com that I speak of? Well, it's actually a shopping site that makes it easy to save money on the stuff that you buy all the time. Prices are going to drop each time you add more items to your cart. So the more you buy, the more you save. It's pretty amazing. And there's free shipping on orders over $35. And get this, there is no membership fee or annual fees. You just get all the benefits without paying an extra price. Free returns within 30 days, two-day delivery on thousands of everyday essential items, and there's 24/7 customer service.
I know for me, I wanted to make our house a smart house. So I went and bought one of those Nest thermostats that you can control with your phone. And now our whole house you can control with my phone, the locks, the windows, the lights, everything. And I did it because of Jet.com, and it was amazing. It's easy. You can do it from your bed. You can do it from your couch. It's a great selection. There's so many. You can get, like we said, we can get like cat litter or cat food if we really want to.
Everything that you already get. And the more you buy, the easier it is because it's cheaper. So rather than going to a store, bothering yourself, or going on some other online site that has an annual membership fee,
Right. You
don't need it. You
right.
don't need it. All right. So you can get $10 off your first three orders over $35 by visiting Jet.com and entering promo code OutlanderCast at checkout. Terms and conditions do apply, so visit Jet.com for details. But once again, $10 off your first three orders over $35, which is already free shipping. All you need to do is go to Jet.com and enter the promo code OutlanderCast at checkout.
All right, so now we're moving on to Act 2.
We are never, ever, ever, ever getting back together.
All right, so we are now finally on Act 2. I know we're moving this along quickly for you, my darling, so we can keep you upbeat here with less coffee, okay?
Okay.
All right, so Act 2. Here is when things in a premiere or a pilot usually turn for our main character in a pilot. X, whatever it is, X happens, and the protagonist's life is completely and utterly altered. So normally they have to do Y as a result of X. Do you understand what I'm saying, my darling?
Sure.
So something
happens,
something
there
X,
needs to be a reaction.
And there has to be a reaction. So X is the action and Y is the reaction. Got it?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So Ron does this, but in a slightly different way. He sets up a possible conflict in Claire's relationship and gives us firsthand experience with the supernatural / superstitious introduced in Act 1 that we already seen. Of course, it's fitting that the next act, Act 2, begins with Claire alone in her room while Frank walks in the rain and lightning, coming to finally find a ghostly Highland Scottish figure staring at Claire through a window,
mm-hmm.
telling you something else is coming, and it's probably going to involve a Scottish person, and Frank is on the out. That's what it seems to be saying.
Because he's outside.
And he's outside, Claire is alone, and there seems to be a certain affection being given between this Scottish person and an unknowing Claire.
Okay.
And it's also fitting now that Frank suggests it would have been okay if Claire had cheated on him, giving what may be a slight hint of self-reflective guilt, which I don't know, but it seems to say that there might be something there. Has he cheated on her, and is he looking for validation? But before we know it, we're back to sex. Because, as we find out in yet another voiceover, it's the only part of their relationship, despite all of the appearances, that makes them feel comfortable. It's their bridge back to each other. We and Frank sense the mysterious nature of his surroundings, and he is certainly off-put by them.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you saw how he acted with the ghost, and he was like, oh, this guy, and telling Claire that she's maybe it was okay if she was cheating
See,
on him.
I didn't think he thought he was like, ghosty. I just thought he has he's, you know, a little nervous and a little excited.
But
I still think,
regardless of whether or not it was ghost, he's still off put by what has happened a little bit.
Yes, but I wouldn't say that he was nervous about like the mysterious nature.
Well, but given his attraction to history that was established in Act One as well, we know that it's only inevitable that he would be interested in exploring the mystic rituals he hears about in town. Thus, he suggests they go watch the druids perform their Samhain ritual at some place that's called Craig Nadun.
Okay, so now we're at the halfway point of the episode. I'm going to take another sip of my iced coffee.
Yes.
I'm with you.
This is the halfway point of the literal episode here of Sassenach. This is when, normally, the major turn of the episode must happen to carry us through the rest of the story that remains throughout the pilot.
Correct.
And we're close. We're so close.
So close.
We get the sense that we've built up this entire episode. Claire, Frank, their relationship, the history, the mysticism. It's all going to collide at this one moment when we see the ritual. And we do see the ritual with Frank and Claire in the dark alone, and Claire seems to be mesmerized. The voiceover says, "Some small voice warned me. I wasn't supposed to be here. I was an unwelcome voyeur to something ancient and powerful." And back to the script, it says, Claire's right. There is something unsettling about the ceremony. Something seems to be touching a deeper chords or of memory and prehistory than simple village tradition. The shadows seem filled with whispers, the night air alive with ancient sprites. Something old and powerful being venerated and awakened in these hills. And of course, the ritual, unfortunately, must end at one point, and so the two, Claire and Frank, must go home. But not before looking at the stones closely, examining some flowers that Claire tells us in another voiceover that she recently got into botany. So as Frank decides the next day to go back to research a newly introduced Blackjack Randall, he suggests Claire goes to see her flowers again at the stones. And naturally, she does. Only to touch the stones and send her somewhere, or rather, some time. So now we have the entire premise of the show. Claire, a powerful, self-reliant nurse, is sent back through time because she touches mysterious stones in a highly superstitious area.
Is this our ex?
Yes. This is our X, but you'll notice that there's no Y yet in Act 2.
Okay.
So what does Claire decide to do because of her experience at the stones? So we don't have our Y yet, but it may come in Act 3.
Okay, so was Act 2 a successful act? Did that one accomplish what it needed to do?
Well, like I said, as my son Reese is in the background doing stamps, yes, and... No.
God, Blake.
What?
You can never just choose a side.
I
love you.
I'm trying not to be the professor here, okay?
Yes.
All right.
No red pen.
All right, so Act 3. Now, given the nature of our main protagonist and how much the weight of the show falls on her shoulders, this is the act of transition for your main character. It takes X's happening and shows Y's reaction, and how our main character starts to transform as a result of it. And Ron accomplishes this too, but once again, in a slightly roundabout way. Claire doesn't necessarily do anything after she hurtles through time. She has nothing to do other than just survive. So Ron Moore shows Claire as a fish out of water. He gives us a real sense of danger because of Blackjack Randall and implements the most favorable of all writing devices, which, do you know what that is, my darling?
No, what?
It's a rescue. There's a guy that has written a book called The Art of Dramatic Writing. It says his name is Lajos Egri. And he says, a man, or in this case for Outlander, a woman, whose fear is greater than his desire, a man who has no great all-consuming passion, or one who has patience and does not oppose, cannot be a pivotal or main character. And while Claire is nothing but reactive in this act, we still see her fulfill Egri's requirement and more in this act and in the following act, Act 4. Claire has to survive, and she must conquer her fear in order to do so. She wakes up at the stones and feels that something is wrong. Her car is missing, and she decides to walk back to Inverness. She's taking control of what her surroundings are. So the script says, a distant pop. Claire gathers herself at the bottom of the hill and looks back up at the way she came, just as three men wearing kilts are running into view. More pops, and we realize that they're actually gunshots as six redcoat soldiers armed with muskets come running in hot pursuit of the Scots. And Claire says, when suddenly confronted with the impossible, the rational mind will grope for the logical. Perhaps I'd stumbled onto the set of a cinema company filming a costume drama of some sort. Another musket fires, and a split second later, a random ball smacks the tree trunk right next to her. She gapes at the tree for a split second. But there was no logical reason for actors to fire live ammunition. She turns and runs, and Bear's music kicks in, and we get a taste of Scottish bagpipes, how scared Claire is, the intensity of the time, and just how unsure and vulnerable she really is at this very moment. We have finally reached our turn. This is what we, the viewer, have been waiting for. Mm-hmm. It's now finally coming in Act 3. And now, finally, we meet the man who will torture her and even Jamie for much of the time to come in Black Jack Randall, who, oddly enough, is her husband's ancestor. We just so happened to be introduced earlier in the episode.
Which is tying in everything we know about Frank and what he was trying to accomplish back in Act 1 of the episode. Okay.
Right. But to make matters worse and having our expectation flipped on our head, because we think of an ancestor of Frank's as being a friendly face, we realize that we are in danger. Claire senses it, and Blackjack knows it. He attacks Claire, and he's subsequently rescued by, and she is subsequently rescued by a Highlander, and brought back to a cabin where, with other Highlanders, where we are introduced to Gaelic-speaking group of men who don't trust Claire, but have no idea how to heal a newly introduced James Fraser's shoulder either. Mm-hmm. Of course, Claire, being the strong woman she is, and the fact that we know that she was a nurse back in World War II, she is quite knowledgeable and can fix it, and she impresses everyone there when she does actually fix it.
Quite knowledgeable is like not even close to describing the knowledge of Claire Fraser.
But you know what I mean. She gets it. She understands.
Yeah.
So she even, and I love this portion, she even tells all the Highlanders basically to go get their shine box the entire during this scene when she's using
like,
bad language.
Yeah,
and
God,
you, don't
yes.
you dare. And all. So we're getting to know Claire even more, and we're seeing the interactions with the Highlanders as well. But despite her reluctant grasp of when she was, she still kind of holds on to where she was. She knew that she was near Inverness, where she thinks Frank is. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it was all just a coincidence, right? I mean, maybe she wasn't in the 1740s. Maybe it was all just a joke. It's only until she realizes she doesn't see the lights of Inverness on the ridge that she knows something is really off. She says in more voiceover, the lights of the city should have been visible for miles. The electric lights, that is. But there were not electric lights as far as the eye could see. The implications of that observation chilled me to the bone. Because as much as my rational mind rebelled against the idea, I knew in my heart that I was no longer in the 20th century.
I feel a segue into the final act coming up.
That's right.
Yes.
Act 4. And this final act is when all of the dots that have been introduced mm-hmm. in the episode, when they finally have to be connected and wrap up for our main character. Or at the very least, we need to see the full brunt of what the show will entail for our protagonist, which in this case, as Claire. And this is where Ron, and I'm willing to say this, really succeeds when he gives us the ride to Leoc. Mm-hmm. The vicious raid, Claire's defiance to escape home, and the eventual arrival to Castle Leoc. Here we see Claire on a ride to Leoc, like I've said, home of the Mackenzie clan. Jaime is hurt, but cares for her on the ride, covering Claire with his plaid, which, again, is more inclination of what's to come for these two. Mm-hmm. But we pass Cock Nemon Rock, the place Frank so conveniently...
I love how you say that in your Boston accent. Cock Nemon Rock. Say it one more time.
Cock Nemon Rock.
What?
Cock Nemon. Cock Nemon.
What?
Cock Nemon.
Just, you pass the rock that looks like a chicken. All right. Goodness.
Yes, the chicken rock.
Cock Nemon Rock.
You know what that means? That's what that is. This is the place that Frank so conveniently taught Claire about earlier in the episode.
Yeah.
Again, tying back into Act One. This knowledge of a British patrol being up there saves the group traveling and gives them edge to defeat a British raid. The battle rages. It's spurned on by the leader, Dougal, who we met back at the cabin. And we know that he is not a man to be trifled with. Mm-hmm. But, of course, none of this is before Dougal demands how Claire knows all of this information. He threatens Claire's life. Again, we know and we now learn that this is not a safe place. Yes, with Black Jack Randall, but even with the Highlanders who saved her. Claire, during the battle, finally makes a choice to leave her Scottish captors, only to be thwarted by Jaime and his patented charm, and to be taken back on the ride to Castle Leoc.
Jumps off that horse. Yep, I know the spot.
Again, more inclination or more indication of what is to come. But Jaime, her protector, of course, is hurt. He was shot. And she must tend to his needs now. She is, after all, a nurse. Which is something that gives her major leverage in this time, mm-hmm. throughout Outlander. And it inspires her to get in even more trouble throughout all of Outlander.
Yep. And she hasn't even been drinking. Well, you know.
Not a whole
time. Not like Sassenach wasted.
So we clearly see that this group is close. We clearly see that Claire and Jaime are going to have some kind of relationship. We clearly see that Claire being a nurse is going to get her in trouble. And we clearly see that Claire does still kind of want to go back home to Frank. And we also see that the group is concerned about Jaime. Well, except that dastardly Dougal, who is focused on his only goal of getting back to his mission. Because of this, we see where his character is eventually going to go. Claire expects iodine to disinfect Jamie's gunshot he sustained in the raid, and we are once again shown that she is not of this time, and her captors haven't any idea what she's talking about. Disinfect? Germs? And Claire replies, alcohol! Oh yes, that these guys understand. And the riot continues, and we are introduced, finally, to Castle Leoc. And where this act really succeeds, and I'm going to say that this act, Act 4, is very successful, because it gives us a sense of the world Outlander, the show, inhabits. There is going to be a lot of tension between the British and the Scottish. There will be battles. There will be a lot of family politics. There will be a lot of running, reacting, and narrow escapes from death from Claire. There will be a lot of dangerous encounters with Black Jack Randall, and there will be a lot of intimacy between our favorite Scott and our favorite Sassenach. We are given a taste of what's to come, and so we are forced to ask ourselves once again, what else happens to this star-crossed lass? Do we want more? What, if anything, is our hook? And our hook is this, the final VO. I'd been here with Frank only yesterday.
Yeah, you did.
Or, yeah, she did. Or, was that in the future? How could I remember something that hadn't happened yet?
I remembered.
So far, I'd been assaulted, I'd been threatened, kidnapped, and nearly raped. And somehow, I knew my journey had only just begun. end of episode.
Okay, so there's the structure of the episode, and what's the point of going over all of this? I love this episode, and I'm done with my coffee. So bring it on. Listen, I'm going to try to shake it. There's only ice cubes.
All right, so through this structure, we see what Ron Moore and company were trying to do. Give us a main character to whom we can relate, someone who feels a tad belittled and searches for more of a home. He introduces friends, villains, gives us a taste of the sci-fi and the action that awaits Claire. And the tease, the love, is about to come.
Okay, but does it work? You said you were going to get the overall effectiveness of the episode earlier. I'm done, Blake.
Done with the coffee.
I'm done. Like, let's... What are you trying to get at?
It's time to pay up.
Yeah.
Time to pay the piper, kiddo.
Yes.
All right. In the end, does it all gel perfectly? Does it all make the best use of its time?
I think yes.
Is it artistically viable as well as entertaining?
Yes.
Well, like I said earlier, yes and no. I think Acts 3 and 4 are nearly perfect.
Yes.
Claire is lost. Scotland is dangerous. And it gives the audience...
Cock, nam, and rock.
It gives the audience the respect of not trying to be cute with the fact that Claire has gone through time.
To cock, nam, and rack.
Even the first act introducing... If you recall, I had a hard time saying that back in the when we did the first episode.
I thought you would have learned it by now rewatches. I know. But alas,
even the first act introducing us to Claire, Frank, and the mysticism of Scotland is pretty much spot on. We learn who they are, why they are there, the status of their relationship, and so we care about what happens to them in the following acts.
Okay, so why are you saying it might not work? Because all of that sounds really good to me.
Because Sassenach, I feel like, suffers from three.
Shame on you. What?
Three major flaws.
Shame on you. Okay, but all right. I'm going to listen. Nobody's perfect. Ron Moore almost is, I guess is what you're saying, right? Ron Moore, I hope you don't take offense to Blake.
Please don't take offense. Ron Moore, if you're listening, and thank you for listening if you are. I know we're good friends. I called you the other day to tell you that we were having this episode, and you said you were okay with it, but, you know, hey, I don't know. You wrote Battlestar Galactica, okay? That's all I'm going to say.
So say we all.
Listen, the first flaw, in my opinion, and this is a big one, is the teaser, okay? Instead of having a really and wholly memorable shot, like, let's say Breaking Bad's shot. Remember of the pants flying up in the air?
Yes.
And you see Walt. You don't know who Walt is, but he's driving the bus and the stuff. Like the liquid is going there. Dead bodies in the RV. He's driving an RV in the desert and he comes out and people are shooting and like, what? Like,
yeah.
Okay. Or a shot of Jack's eye in the opening of Lost.
We have to go back, Kate.
Or, you know, Jack is going through the woods and you see the shoe hanging down from the bamboo and he runs out. There's a plane that's exploded. And
you're just saying, what in the world is going on?
Right. Or even a more subtle shot like House of Cards and Frank Underwood, spoiler alert, going out, seeing the dog that's injured, and he goes out and he snaps the dog's neck.
Oh, God. I forgot about that.
And the total surprise is not only does he do that, but he looks directly at the camera and speaks to you, the viewer, breaking the fourth wall. Those things never happen on television, right? Those are memorable shots. But with Sassenach, we open on the Scottish Highlands and a voiceover, which, of course, like we already talked about, was followed up by Claire looking at the vase and remembering back to her time in World War II. And while none of it is inherently boring, it's okay. It's just not exciting. It's not full. It's there. Okay. Yes, the voiceover teases a mystery of Claire's desire for home and her choice that she would make over again despite all of the death and all of the heartbreak. But we don't learn anything about the show we're about to watch. with Lost, we knew that this was going to be about a bunch of people. A plane had yep. crashed, and it was going to be mysterious. It was going to be crazy. With Breaking Bad, we knew that it was going to be a guy. He's going to be death-defying. He was going to be in danger tons of the times. It was interestingly shot. It was in a real rare setting in New Mexico. We knew all those things going into it. But with Outlander, we don't know anything. We know that Claire is a nurse and she wants a home. But what is the show itself mm-hmm. about? And of course, we know that the show is about Claire going back in time, learning to survive in spite of all the odds, and going to measures to make sure she actually overcomes her fear of this dangerous time and all the things that come along with it. So what I would like to do is this. I would like to reset, all right, if we could take the teaser out.
Hold up. Okay, so you want us to imagine. We're going to like close our eyes and Blake Larson is going to be the showrunner for a second.
Yes, if Blake Larson was the showrunner of Outlander.
Of the season premiere. Of the series premiere of Outlander. Okay, right. I'm going to close my eyes.
This is how my teaser would go, okay? Instead of opening up on a static shot of the Highlands, followed up by Claire and Inverness in World War II, let's actually cut straight to the point where Claire wakes up after traveling through the stones.
Okay.
The opening shot is Claire's face. We pan up and out to reveal the whole scene with the stones. We zoom out, okay? We don't pan up, but we zoom out from her face, showing the entire scene, okay? With the stones and the beautiful coloring, we could even keep the same voiceover that we had. People disappear all the time.
Love it.
So then as a viewer, we're asking, what are those stories? Well, I mean, what are those stones? Why is she laying here? What is this? Mm-hmm. So we follow this woman through the woods. We think that she has left somewhere, given her voiceover that she had.
Yeah.
But we don't know where, and we don't know her, but we sympathize because clearly she is dazed, she's scared. We don't know why, but we want to know why. Most are found eventually. Disappearances, after all, have explanations. And Claire continues to walk through the woods, and a running blur catches her attention, usually. And then all of a sudden, she looks back and says, what the hell was that? We, the viewer, asking.
She doesn't say what the hell is that, yeah.
We, the viewer, saying, what the hell is that? Is someone following her? Is this the person that she's trying to escape? Mm-hmm. Will she be caught? We, like she, are now scared, confused, and totally freaking intrigued. And then back to the script, a distant pop. Claire gathers herself at the bottom of the hill and looks back up the way she came, just as three men wearing kilts are running into view. More pops, and we realize that there are actually gunshots, and redcoat soldiers are running, armed with muskets, and come running in hot pursuit of the Scots. Then there's more voiceover. When suddenly confronted with the impossible, the rational mind will grope for the logical. Perhaps, maybe I had stumbled onto the set of a cinema company filming a costume drama of some sort.
Wouldn't that have been lovely?
We, the viewer, now, like, we get the understanding now. She is clearly not, she doesn't know where she is. She really doesn't even know when she is, because she's saying, maybe I'm at a cinema, mm-hmm. but the people wearing these things are not really cinema. We know that because another musket fires, and a split second later, a random ball smacks the tree trunk right next to her. She gapes at the tree for a split second. But there was no logical reason for actors to fire live ammunition. She turns and runs, and this is where Bear's music runs to life, and the girl we don't know, but are rooting for to survive, this really random circumstance runs for her life. We follow her every move, breathless, confused, our hearts race with every footstep she takes. Where the hell is this woman? No, better yet, when the hell is this woman?
There you go.
She runs, trips, and falls, and all is silent, even the music, until we see a man at a gully, a redcoat, a savior. Surely this man could help. And we feel better when the woman apparently recognizes him.
Hello.
The woman says a name. Frank? Yes. Oh, finally, yes. Good. She knows him. At last, someone can save her. And because we have been with her this entire time, we have finally actually grasped onto this woman. We empathize and now sympathize with her. This man is saving us, the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
But by his reaction, we know that this is not Frank.
That look. Ugh.
Something is wrong. We are not supposed to be in this place. Better yet, we get the sudden feeling that we're not supposed to be in this time. And then, boom, smash cut, opening
love,
titles.
Love.
That is my teaser. And then, of course, the rest of the show can go on as it's already written. You can keep the vase. You can keep the World War II flashback, all of it. Then we get to the third act. We realize why we were running in the teaser. It gives us an entirely new context to the scene when we see Claire wake up at those stones again. But by giving us this different teaser, we get the Scottish music, we get Blackjack, we get Claire, we get the danger she is in, we get the concept of what the entire show will be like. A fight for Claire's life. Right? Does that make sense?
It does, and it's exhilarating, and you're like, boom, 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 why is she there? What's going on? Who are these people? Oh my God. And you care so much. You know what? I'm on board with that.
Thank
Had
you.
We opened with that, I feel like my heart would have been going thump, 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 thump.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Sign me up.
The second major flaw. Claire is reasoning for touching the stones. Okay. Claire has no reason to touch them in the show. That's just fact, not opinion. Okay.
Yeah.
Wind picks up as she touches the flowers and she just decides to touch the stones because reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Really. That's what it is. Reasons.
Just cause.
To be honest, it doesn't make sense. And she just does it because she just does it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to see her be a little bit more uneasy with her life. Maybe suffer from flashbacks of being a nurse in World War II, which would tie back into the flashback that we saw during her healing all the guys. I would like to see her be a little bit more unhappy with Frank. Not unhappy, but uneasy with Frank. Especially after he questions her fidelity later on in Act 2.
Mm-hmm.
I want her to be more enthralled by the mysticism of Scotland and by the palm reading. She was... But it just kind of came and went. And I want to see it on her face as she watches the summoning. This should be a woman who was desperately trying to rekindle her love and her life with Frank after being apart for so long. And she doesn't really want to leave, yes. But we should know that something is missing. Something is calling to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to know that Frank isn't the answer for Claire.
Yeah.
Not by being told, but by, again, seeing her unease. I need to know all of this. The war, the Frank, and the mysticism are creating a vacuum in Claire so that when she touches the stones, not only is it her choice, but it's spiritual. It's her fate. Touching the stones should be inevitable for Claire. The funny thing is, in the script, Claire actually hears a buzzing coming from the stones during the summoning and right before she touches them. And this is what it says. Suddenly, she begins to hear a hum in the air. You can't make out what direction it's coming from. Claire says, "You hear that?" And Frank says back to her, "Hmm?" And this small tidbit between Frank and Claire speaks, no, actually, I think it screams volumes for Outlander. We know that the humming is special.
Mm-hmm.
We know it's special because Claire can hear it, and only Claire can hear it. Something about these stones is calling her. So when she returns to the stones after being looked over again by Frank to go search out his ancestors on their honeymoon, we know that something is missing from Claire. Knowing this as she touches the flowers and the humming happens again later on when she returns, we see and hear it, not just as the humming she heard earlier, although it may sound the same, but we as the viewer, given what we now know of Claire, the vacuum that's been inside of her, the humming is the sound of what's missing in her life.
Oh.
It's the sound of her destiny.
Mm-hmm.
So back to the script, it says, gradually she becomes aware of that same humming, like what a beehive might produce. Claire looks around curiously, and after a few seconds, she zeroes in on the source, which is not a hive, but actually the largest of the stones, the one with a huge split running down the middle. Standing right next to the stone, the humming is loud, and Claire puts a hand out to touch the surface. The stone screams. Claire backpedals. The scream was unnatural, otherworldly. Suddenly, there were sounds of battle nearby, screaming men, musketry, terrified horses, the clang of metal weapons. The cacophony grows more intense, and Claire realizes the sounds are coming from the stone itself. She reaches out a hand in curiosity and touches the stone. Cut to black. But the show, despite it being in the script, doesn't do any of this. It doesn't tie in her war experience. It doesn't tie in the battle sounds. It doesn't tie in the humming. It doesn't make her want to touch it other than just because we, the viewer, are left with nothing but, okay, she touched the stones.
See, so as a book reader, we know all that stuff.
But as a show watcher, I don't.
You're just like, this girl just got up and touched the stone.
She touched because reasons.
She felt compelled. I compel you.
We've already established that Claire is a strong woman earlier. One who demands her partner to be intimate with her. One who isn't afraid of battle. One who doesn't feel at home. One who doesn't feel that this is whole with her husband. Yet, she isn't taking her destiny in her own hands by touching the stones in the show. None of those things in the show call to her. Instead of going through the stones, being her ex, and then reacting to it by trying to survive, X should be what we just watched prior to the stones. X should be her version of herself that is missing. X should be the humming, the culmination of all of her life. And the Y should be her touching the stones because she can no longer make sense of her ex. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Her why should be a reaction to the presence of the stones, not falling through the stones.
Mm.
Instead of being a proactive protagonist who touches the stones with a purpose, in the show, Claire touches them more out of coincidence and mistake. And because of this, Claire is reduced to a passive and reactive protagonist. Yeah, she's reactive.
We're just talking show.
Okay, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I just need to take a step back because, as I said, we're just taking this as a show and this is how you see.
And the irony is that we all know Claire is anything but passive.
Exactly.
But by not having a specific reason for her touching these stones other than reasons, she is reactive. That's it. Another added and indirect benefit, of course, is seeing Claire touch the stones and eventually wake up. That would eventually bring us back to our teaser, our fake teaser in showrunner Blake Larson world that we had already established at the beginning of this episode. It would provide an entirely new layer to her running through the woods eventually. Instead of our initial interpretation that this was by accident or that she was scared or who knows why this happened, we can recognize that her trek through the stones and through the stars and space and time and everything, it's full of purpose, one that she actually willingly took on. The third flaw, and I hate to say this, but it's true. It's the voiceovers.
Oh, you know what? You're not alone on this, so don't worry.
I know.
Don't worry.
We all know the voiceovers are rough. It's too much information. It's too often. Some excuses I've heard that allow their existence is that this script is highlighting the famous parts from the text of the book.
Yes.
Okay, fine. Great. But my answer to those people and those excuses is this. If it's part of the text of the book, let them stay text. Text is text. Film is film. Okay? Tell the story visually. A bad example of useless VO is when Claire and Frank walk to through the empty abandoned ruin of Leok. The voiceover tells us that Frank's new passion was genealogy, yet we are immediately treated to a line from Frank detailing the Mackenzie clan line and their history there right after. Wait, what? Why? We don't need that VO.
Yeah.
Frank just told us.
Yeah.
And his interest in history has already told us. Let that line and let his actions speak for themselves. We can infer this new passion. Of course, voiceovers are meant to inform us about points that we cannot get from the visual or the natural conversation between people.
Correct.
For example, a good use was the following VO, shortly after the walk into the kitchen of Leok. In a way, burying himself in the distant past gave Frank an ability to escape the recent. While I was in the army, Frank had served in London, MI6, overseeing spies, running covert operations, that sort of thing. I knew he'd sent dozens of men behind the enemy lines on secret missions, and most of them never came back. And he didn't talk about it very often, but I knew it preyed on him. That VO is perfect.
Yes.
Because it shows the two walking through this abandoned ruin. He is distant. He is quiet. She is walking around. He is doing his own thing. He's in his own world.
But we would have never known those other facts.
Right, but we would never have known them. Mm-hmm. It sheds light on what we're watching and why we're watching it.
Yeah.
It informs us emotionally, factually, and it gives us a different perspective of the scene as they walk through those grungy Leok halls. Mm-hmm. Really, in the end, we understand why not only Frank is the way that he is, but why we are where we are. Mm-hmm. But even though there are some good ones, the worst VO, in my opinion, is right after they enter the room at Mrs. Baird's for the first time. Their bedroom. Frank mentions that the room is not, of course, without its charms, and Claire retorts that it's better than a tent in the war. The two are clearly not comfortable being alone with each other yet. But instead of letting the scene breathe for itself, and that uncomfortable feeling that permeates as they traverse the room silently, we get another damn voiceover. And it's this. When the war ended, we both thought things would return to the way they once were. But they hadn't.
Why would they do that?
Why?
You're hitting your head against the mic.
Why?
Like, we totally understood. We could read the body language.
The silence says way more than that voiceover. Of course, there are countless more of examples, and it all leads to one problem. Sassenach doesn't trust the viewer to see what it wants to show. It just tells you.
Sassenach was a little too by the book.
It was by the book. And it wasn't by the book. It did a lot of good things. It did a lot of bad things.
Okay. What? Oh.
And I think...
Do you like that like awkward brain fart I just had? Am I a caveman? That's what happens when I stop drinking coffee.
another one that really that just popped up into my mind real quick is we're talking about Cock, Nam, and Rock. And of course, Frank points this thing out. Mm-hmm. And of course, Claire just happens to walk by it. And of course, it flashes back to Frank telling the whole history lesson again about Cockneman Rock or whatever, however the hell you, Chicken Rock, however you pronounce it. That, it, like, we the viewer, they should not flash back to Frank telling us that story again. And it's also a little convenient that he just happens to talk about this rock and she just happens to go by. It's a little all too convenient for me. And that is what I think the problem with Sassenach is. It's just too neat. Mm-hmm. It's too clean. It introduces things. It brings them back up again. Cocknam and Rock is a perfect example.
Cocknam and Rock.
It's just too neat. So, and it just tries too hard to tell you what it wants to be. So this and the other two problems that I have mentioned, in my eyes, ultimately prevents Sassenach from being an all-time great first episode like the pilots of The Leftovers. Remember the baby and the mother who was, spoiler alert,
yeah.
The Leftovers is about people, if 2% of the world's population disappears and the mother walks out of a laundromat and she's frustrated and she's haggard and she got this screaming baby and she's talking to her husband about getting milk and this and that and she's all pissed off and the baby's crying in the back, pans to the woman. She's talking and she's trying to calm the baby, but she's doing it like a half-assed job. And all of a sudden, it pans to the baby. There it is. Pans back to the woman and the baby stops crying. You think, oh, okay, that's cool. But then it pans back to the kid and the kid's just gone.
Just an empty car seat.
Empty car seat. She gets out of the car. She starts screaming. We don't know where anything is happening. And boom, title card, The Leftovers.
Yep.
Perfect. Sassenach is not The Leftovers. It's not Lost. It's not Breaking Bad. It's not even House of Cards. It's good. Mm-hmm. It is entertaining. It's fun. And I think it's a decent representation and expression of what's to come. But it's not the best. And that is my analysis of Sassenach, my love.
You're such a Debbie Downer at the very end. That's really how you're going to end it?
Well, how would you like me to... You're the showrunner today.
No, I'm not. You kind of were.
You're the showrunner. Okay, let's just say that you are. I made my tease for Outlander. How would you expect that I end today's show?
I'm the showrunner. I thought you were the showrunner. I'm very confused.
Well, I teased myself as a showrunner for the teaser of Outlander. Okay, let's tease you as the showrunner today for our episode of what we just did for Sassenach. How would you end this episode?
Right now?
Yes.
I would say that for me, as a book reader, then show watcher, I loved Sassenach. I was not only introduced to the characters that I've known so much about, but also to the characters that I didn't. Mm-hmm. Scotland. Bear McCreary score, Rhea Yarborough, the set design,
right. All
this stuff that like got a little mentioned by you, but those were major to me. They were major, major players for this episode.
Okay.
So I loved this episode. I felt like it was the great first chapter of a book. It got you into a situation, got you to know the characters, got you to realize what was going on. I do agree with you wholeheartedly that the beginning of the episode could have started with Claire already being through the stones.
Right.
I do agree with you about that. I think that that would have been a bit more compelling. But aside from that, I really loved this episode. So that's how I'm going to end
it. Listen, I'm going to say I loved the episode too. I enjoyed it. I had fun with it. And it, like I said, it has a lot of its merits. Introducing you to the world, it really does that very well. And it is beautifully shot. It is the Bear McCreary's music is really outstanding. His best work since Battlestar Galactica. There's no question about it. And one could argue that it's better than Battlestar Galactica. Mm-hmm. I won't, but one could. There are a lot of great things about Sassenach. I think there are things that it could improve upon. And if I had a chance to go back and tell Ron Moore in a time machine, if I went through the stones and I could go back to Ron and say, hey, this is what I would do, he'd probably, you know, push me aside and say, get away, boy. And I would respect that because the man has written Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica and you know, he is an amazing man and very talented. But those are the changes that I would have made. But I did love Sassenach. It is what it is. All right, my darling, are you ready to close out this Emmy Award-winning episode of Outlander Cast?
Yes.
All right, let's do it.
Ladies and gents, this, of course, is Outlander Cast. You can find us on all sorts of social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. That is where we're at. Our handles on all of those are simply Outlander Cast. We'd also love for you to check out the Outlander Cast blog. This is your go-to place for Droughtlander. Okay?
Right.
We have an amazing, amazing staff from around the world who delve into the episodes, who interview Davina Porter, the voice of the audiobooks for Outlander. That's just newly out, so definitely check that out. We have a new blog post about a recap from Outlander in the City, an Outlander event that several of us went to. So,
or even Anne Gavin's travels throughout Scotland.
Oh my gosh, so if you're thinking about going to Scotland, Anne Gavin is your girl. Like, you just need to read these and soak them up and love on them. We also want to invite you to join our exclusive Facebook group, the Outlander Cast Clan Gathering. That's what you type in when you go to Facebook, Outlander Cast Clan Gathering. And we most certainly are asking, if I were on my knees, I would tell you I was on my knees, but I'm on a yoga ball, to possibly think about becoming a patron. You go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/OutlanderCast. You can donate as little as $1 a month, $2, whatever. It goes up in increments. This is how we help produce the show. It started as a little hobby. The hobby of podcasting is a little expensive, but this is how we defer the cost from it, and this is how we take things to the next level. And for those of you who literally sat here being like, Blake, I hate you. You know nothing because you did not read Outlander, and you're driving me flipping crazy, Blake Larson. If that was you and you want him to read the book, we are getting closer every single day to our Patreon goal of $650 per month to have Blake read. Like, that's like the new incentive, okay?
Right.
Is to
I will
have
read
him
the book.
Read the book and do a chapter by chapter analysis for patrons only.
Right.
So get on that, guys.
Or if you really liked what I did here, and if you think, wow, man, that was actually pretty good. Like, I appreciate that. And if you think what Mary and I do are a good enough value to you and for you in your Outlander experience, and you would like us to continue making episodes like this, mm-hmm. Then do please consider being a patron for $1 or $2 per month. And the most important thing that I would like you to do, Everyone always talks about reviews on iTunes, and yes, of course, those are great. But the most important thing you can do for us is tell a friend that we exist. Tell a friend about this episode. Mm-hmm. Be like, dude, this guy is so full of crap. You need to hear this. Or, man, this wasn't all that bad. Like, listen to this thing. Like, tell somebody about this episode. And if you liked it, if they liked it or whatever.
Yes.
And share that with them.
What I would also love, you know, you talked about iTunes. I'm just going a little long right here. If you haven't yet reviewed us in iTunes, head on over. And if you want to leave us comments specifically about this episode, if you have something you want to say to Blake, if you are like, oh my gosh, thank you for going in depth. Thank you for keeping us company in Droughtlander. Blake, goodness gracious, we love you, but you need to read the book.
Or Blake, you suck.
No. Well, yes. But you could also leave that in an iTunes review. You know, we check those.
Yep.
So please know that we love you and we appreciate all of the feedback and we appreciate you, our clan members. We appreciate you all and we hope that you have a most lovely, lovely day. For now, I'm Mary Larson.
My name's Blake.
And you've been listening to Outlander Cast.